Okay, we'll go through a quick meditation, and then second half will be discussion of how to set up your meditation by your behavior during the rest of the day. Okay, so first we'll do a standard short meditation, and then we'll go ahead and talk about what I call office meditation. All right, so try to get your position right. It's your right leg up on your left thigh, okay? Something on your lap to hold your hands. Left hand down first. Right hand on top of that. Thumbs touching. Back very straight. Neck straight. Okay, chin not too far up, not too far down. Eyes straight ahead, okay? Either close them or look down somewhere in space here, but don't focus them, okay? Like, close your eyelids halfway and look down, or else close them all together, okay? And then watch your breath, okay? Normally we count 10 breaths. I found that about 3 rounds is good for a typical meditation. So count your breath coming in and out. One out and one in, it counts as the first one. And then out and in counts as the second one, and like that, okay? So we'll do this for about a few minutes, and then we'll move on to a standard meditation warm-up, okay? Mouth very loose. Next step is to, of the preliminaries of the warm-up, is to try to imagine why you're going to meditate. What do you hope to accomplish? And the main thing is to realize that you are inevitably getting older and going to die. And that everything you're doing with your life is, if you leave it like that, it's doomed to fail or to end. And you'd like to find some other way. That's taking refuge. That's the main reason to meditate. The next step of the warm-up is to think of bodhicitta, compassion. Try to think of someone that you know who is sick or not well, mentally or physically, and wish that you could help them. The next part of the warm-up is to visualize a holy being in front of you. It could be anyone that you feel is holy, but be sure that you try to visualize the most perfect being you can imagine. And then try to think of their good qualities. And we say bow down to them in your mind, but think of some good quality, holy quality they have that applies to you personally, meaning which is helpful to you or which you would like to learn to have yourself. Next, make some offering to them, even if it's just in your mind, but something that they would like from you. You can think of a flower, or you can cover the sky with flowers, or offer the ocean, or your own good deeds are very good to offer also. Something good you did in the last day or two. Something to please them, which is the meaning of the word puja. The next step is to purify your mind and think of something that negative that you've done in the last 24 hours or so, something very specific. And try to think about how you'll try not to do it again. Then next step is to think of something good you've done in the last 24 hours and something specific that you did nice for someone else, good thing that you did, and be happy about it, rejoice in it. There are two more steps to the preliminaries or warming up. The next one is to request teachings. And that could be formal teachings like these teachings, or it could be informal teachings like someone getting angry at you and showing you how short your temper is and that you learn something from them. So request those kinds of teachings. Request that you always find teachers. The last step is requesting those teachers to stay in the world, like His Holiness the Dalai Lama or any other great teachers in the world, that you ask them to stay in this world. Because without them, we wouldn't be able to learn anything. We wouldn't be able to do much on our own. We start a small meditation. Think of that holy being. Make the outline clear in your mind as if it was a silhouette, like there was a light behind them. And then focus on the face, try to get the eyes clear, just the eyes. So you have a silhouette and then the eyes, the outline of the eyes, and the eyebrows. Then try to get the nose and the mouth. Then the hair and the rest of the face. And then the chest and the arms. And then their whole body and their whole face and their head, the whole thing. And then try to fill it in with the other senses, fill in the warmth of their body. And then give them some kind of scent, some nice scent to them. And then lastly, all the little movements of the body, like the chest breathing and moving up and down, the eyes blinking once in a while, little movements of the body. And then their mind, think of their mind inside the body, totally happy and totally loving, and no anger, no negativity at all, just perfect, beautiful thoughts, wanting to help people. Then the last step is to ask them to bless your mind, and you're going to ask them to come inside of you. So they start to rise from their seat, and then as they rise, they get smaller, and they turn to face the same way as you, and they rise to the top of your head, and they sit on the top of your head, and they're very small, about 2-3 inches high. And finally they rest on the top of your head, facing the same way as you. And then they get smaller and smaller, and they start to come down towards your heart. And they move down in front of your backbone. Back should be very straight. About an inch in front of your backbone, and they start coming down. Now they're about the size of like a pea. And then you see them at your heart or a little bit behind your heart, closer to the backbone, about an inch in front of the backbone, and they're inside of this beautiful little golden chamber. And see them there and feel the warmth of them, the light, and they're sitting there very, very happy, very relaxed, very happy with you, and they blessing the light from them is blessing your body all day long. Then the last thing we do is to, just doing that meditation is a very powerful good karma. And you imagine that that light goes out of your body. They say it goes out of your pores, of your skin, like thousands and thousands of rays of light. And they go out and strike other people and make them happy. They give them what they hope for. So imagine that. That's the last thing. Okay, relax then. One important thing for your meditation is not only what you do before the meditation. Like if you don't know how to warm up before meditation, like what we just did, then we would say that the meditation won't go very well. So you need to be able to do all those steps that we went through. And we'll go through it one more time next Monday. So you know, I would suggest you bring like a small tape recorder next Monday, and then I'll do that again, and then you can play the tape to yourself until you get used to it, and then you can throw it away, okay? But that's a good custom to do that warm-up. We say that if you don't do the warm-up properly, you won't be able to do the meditation properly. So that's why we say some people who just flop down and try to close their eyes and think about something, it may not succeed. You have to do that all those steps that we talked about before meditation, okay? What I'm going to talk about today is something that was taught by Arya Nagarjuna. He lived about 17 centuries ago in India, and he outlined all the conditions for a good meditation that you have to do outside of meditation, meaning you know, you're meditating in the morning from like, 7 o'clock to 8 o'clock or something like that. But what do you do from 8 a.m. to 7 a.m. the next morning? And how does that affect your meditation? Okay, and so Nagarjuna wrote a very beautiful thing about that. And we'll go through some of the points in his presentation of it. I guess the first one would be, nimuk ni, say nimuk.
Nimuk.
Okay, nimuk means a special enemy of meditation called sleep and drowsiness. Okay, ni means sleep, muk means drowsiness. And this means if you want to meditate well, you have to have had enough sleep. Okay, if you're sleepy, you can't meditate. All right, impossible, pretty much impossible. Right, nimuk means getting drowsy or getting sleepy. So, you know, without sleeping too much, which also makes you dull, the idea is to make sure you get enough sleep. And a lot of people I know, Westerners who try to meditate, they have problem meditating because they don't sleep enough. Okay, or they don't wake with enough sleep. So Nagarjuna said, if you want to be a good meditator, you have to be very careful to get enough sleep. That's different for each person, and it also depends on your other circumstances. Like I used to not get enough sleep 5 days a week, and then sleep extra on the weekend or something like that, because I was working. You know, it took me 2 hours to get to work or something like that. So, I mean, it was pretty much impossible. And then you make it up. So it depends on your circumstances and your body, but it's important to get enough sleep, okay? Then there's another one called gugyu. Say gugyu.
Gugyu.
Gugyu. Gugyu means, this is very interesting. Gugyu means your mind is wandering to things that you're busy about, like specifically I think for people in New York and for people who have a good job or they have some kind of career, that gu can be very dangerous. Gu means having too much to think about or too much to do. too many thoughts, okay? And that's just a habit all day long. Go means getting distracted to too many things, and specifically too many physical objects, meaning eating too much. They would say listening to music too much or something like that, reading newspapers and magazines too much, watching the news too much, watching television in general. Gopa means exposing yourself to too much stimulus, okay? Too much stimulation of your mind. And that's very hard in New York. I mean, just to walk down the street is gopa, you know? But you have to try to limit it. Some of the gopa that you undergo is voluntary and some it's not. You know, like walking down the street in New York, all those guys on Madison Avenue, are, you know, the best brains in New York are fighting to make sure you get gopa, you know? And that's sort of involuntary. Like, you can't tell them to take down all the advertising in New York or to take off all the covers of all the magazines or like that. They're not going to do it, I don't think. But the question is there voluntary gopa that you are contributing? You know what I mean? And they would say, I mean, for meditation, it'd be like reading the news too much, you know? Like, it's enough to just scan the cover of the New York Times or something. You'll find out everything you need to know practically, okay? You don't have to read the whole New York Times. You don't have to watch the news every day. It doesn't change much from day to day. You know, you can watch the week in review or something. You know what I mean? So it's enough. You don't need that much information. You can't do anything with it. It doesn't really relate to your life. And even if it did, you're going to die anyway. So it's not as important as meditation. Okay? So you have to die. You don't know if you're going to live. So you might as well forego the newspaper. You know, I mean, mainly, most of the things in there are just information that takes up brain cells. The more you have in your mind, the less you'll be able to concentrate and meditate. You know, it's important to know what's going on. It's important to be responsible. It's important to be an informed citizen and to do the things that are necessary to help other people. But see if there's like worthless information that you are loading into your mind just because you don't have anything to do for half an hour. You know, and you're reading a magazine or something like that. Just for stimulation, okay? The same with food. I mean, eat enough food to make sure that you're healthy. But to eat foods which are not healthy and to eat too much food is a great obstacle to meditation. It's much easier to meditate if your body is light. And it's almost impossible to meditate within 2 hours after eating, okay? So it's important to... A, schedule your feeding times well, and then B, make them a lot lighter. You know, I have some students, we made a deal that every time we go to eat somewhere, we'll split one plate of food. So we actually order one thing and we share it 50-50, you know, and some of my students are doing that. And then we find out there's still left over. You know what I mean? I mean, New York City, what you get on one plate is plenty, and we just eat that once or twice a day. So you don't need the third time usually. The third feeding is usually unnecessary, and the other two feedings can be half as much, you know. And it's fine. It works fine. You know, I've been doing that for a year or two, and I didn't die or anything. So you know, it's about what you need. Okay. So the other thing is to avoid drowsiness that way. Okay. And to avoid too much sense input. Like, a lot of Americans will turn on the TV or turn on the radio just for stimulation, not because they're listening to it. And that all piles up in your mind. When you sit down and meditate in the morning, whether or not you're successful depends about 80% on what you do outside of meditation. You see what I mean? If your way of life doesn't support meditation, then don't think that the 1 hour a day is somehow going to cancel the 23 hours. You see what I mean? Your way of life has to be a meditative way of life, okay? Gyur means regret, and in Tibetan, gyupasa means to entertain regrets or to feel regrets about something. But in Nagarjuna's text, which is the Surlekha, it's a letter he wrote to a king, a letter of advice he wrote to a king. In his book, gyupa means thinking about the good old days, all right? Like thinking what could have been or what might be, you know. I think Baba Ram Das said, "Be here now," you know, something like that. And I think Nagarjuna, in this case, would say the same thing. Okay, he'd say, try to be in the present time. Okay, gyupa means it's very destructive. It hurts your meditation a lot if you're living outside of the present. You know, you're thinking about what might have been with that guy or that girl last year. You're thinking about when you used to be more handsome or pretty or healthy. You're thinking about that job you used to have. Or you're thinking about what might happen 6 weeks from now if you do that thing today, or what could be later, or what might happen, or something like that. Just your mind refusing to be in the present moment. Okay, it's destructive for meditation. It doesn't mean that a Buddhist shouldn't plan the future. You should plan the future, but not during your meditation session. Okay, and it also doesn't mean that you should ignore the past. It's good to think about the good things in your past, and it's good to remember good things, and that's healthy. But during your meditation session, you have to be here and not somewhere in the past or in the future. And if you spend too much of your day being outside of the present moment, then it will hurt your meditation. Okay. There's another one called nirsam. Say nirsam.
Nirsam.
This is the most destructive. I mean, we talked about the destructiveness of desirable objects, you know, like thinking too much about your food, listening to music too much, you know, to where when you sit down, your mind is just repeating everything you've heard. You know, you sit down and part of your mind is worrying about how many... I saw two people discussing the New York Times the other day, how many cars go through the Holland Tunnel every day, you know. So do you really want that going to your mind while you're meditating? You know what I mean? This is Sunday morning. This couple was enjoying the New York Times, and they were throwing facts at each other, you know, and do you really want that to come into your mind while you're meditating, you know, or maybe, you know, that last three songs you heard on the radio or something? They're not evil, okay? It's not that music is a bad thing. Music is a great, wonderful, beautiful thing. When you get to Buddha paradise, there'll be music all the time. But if it distracts you, and if tunes are popping off in your head while you're trying to meditate, then you have to choose, you know, one or the other. You can't have both for the time being, okay? When your mind is stronger later on, maybe you can listen to more. Okay. Last one, though, is very destructive, called nirsam. Nirsam means thinking about someone you don't like, or thinking about some situation that you don't like. Okay, some problem you're having at work, some person you have a trouble with, something like that. You have to be very careful during meditation to keep those out of your mind. Okay, desirable things have this way to kind of lower your meditation to a degree where it's not sharp anymore. But any kind of anger thought has the ability to destroy your meditation completely for the next hour. Okay? Like, if you really think of someone you don't like during a meditation session, or if you ever go on a long tantric retreat and your mind starts getting onto some problem you're having with somebody, you'll find out that you can ruin an hour, or you can ruin a day, or you can ruin 2 weeks of meditation. Just by your mind getting off on somebody you don't like, you know. So very important during meditation to shut that out, you know, stop thinking about that. All of these apply to meditation, and they apply more importantly to the time outside of meditation, okay? In other words, during the day you should go around, you know, you have a chance to eat some cookies, you know, and you're looking at them and you're saying, okay, do I want to be a meditator or do I want to eat these cookies, you know? And then you have to decide for the meditation. I mean, your body gets ruined cookie by cookie. It's not like you have one day when they offer you all the cookies and you ruin it in one day. It's like slow and steady, and it ruins your body. Or there's like three magazines on the table and you're reaching for one, and then you say, do I really want this in my mind when I meditate tomorrow? You know, and then just stop and just do something more meaningful. You know what I mean? And the same with the minute you have a bad thought about somebody or someone starts to irritate you, then you have to make a decision during the day. You have to say, do I want to get mad at this person or do I want to have a good meditation tomorrow? Because if I get angry at them, it's going to infect my meditation tomorrow. You know what I mean? And this is meditator. If you decide to be a professional meditator, these are decisions you have to make all day long. That's the point. Nagarjuna says, I'm not just talking about the meditation period. I'm talking about outside of the meditation period. There's a bodhisattva vow that you have, if you took bodhisattva vows, that you have to try to fight those things we talked about today. It's a vow, okay? And then when Jetsun Kapa describes the vow, he says, by the way, we're not just talking during your meditation sessions. We're talking about while you're at work, And during your day, you're under vows. If you took bodhisattva vows, if you ever took a tantric initiation, you have this vow. If you took vows Saturday night, you have this vow. You're under vow. You took a solemn vow to try to avoid these things that ruin your meditation. Okay, so, and part of the vow is that I'll try to avoid them between meditation sessions as well. Okay, so constantly during the day, you have to be evaluating the things that might ruin your meditation. Okay, the habit of not being present, the habit of eating too much, the habit of reading and looking at television and listening to radio, the things that you don't need and they're not going to help you or anyone else. Okay, that kind of stimulation, the habit of allowing yourself even a moment's irritation at someone else, much less anger, because all of that will degrade your meditation, you know. And then there's so many Americans that say, I don't know how to meditate. And then you meet a few who say they know how to meditate. And then they say, I don't have time to meditate. And then you meet a few who say, I do have time to meditate, but not regularly, you know, not every day. I do like every third day or so. Then you meet other ones who say, I do it every day. I really do it every day. And then you meet ones that say, I do it for an hour every day, because there's lots of people who do it for 20 minutes every day, okay? I mean, we're going down, 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 right? And then there's people who say, I do it every day, and I've been doing it every day for 5 years, and nothing happened, you know? I don't feel more clear. I don't have better concentration. I still am bored by meditation. I do it because I swore I'd do it to my lama, you know? And nothing's happening. I didn't have any amazing things happen to me. And that's because of this degraded meditation, low-grade meditation. Low-grade meditation is like trying to meditate with all this crap in your mind, and then you won't be able to meditate, okay? And then you can sit there for an hour a day. If you're very disciplined, you can sit there and just be bored for an hour a day, you know? Nothing will change, okay? What does it feel if you start to get good meditation? It also starts to overflow into your daily life. Your mind gets more clear. You can solve problems immediately. You can concentrate on things. You have this incredible insight into things. Like, other people are discussing this problem and struggling with this problem, and you just walk in and say, hey, there's a totally different solution you guys didn't think about. You know what I mean? And you're able immediately to decide things. You not have any kind of indecision. Your mind is totally strong, powerful. You can see solutions where nobody sees them. I don't care if it's business or art, if you want to be creative, all of this makes you more creative. I mean, you're so creative, you can't stop it. You know, like, just everything seems different, and everything is incredible, and you can do anything you want mentally. I mean, that's, if you meditate well, you can get, your whole rest of your life will go very well. And if the rest of your life is lousy, then your meditation will be lousy. How's that? Okay. Last thing I'm going to describe tonight is, we have about half an hour. There's a very famous incident. Jetsun Kapa had a student from East Tibet, from a place called Gerong. And that's like Nevada or something like that. Okay, I mean, nobody's there in Gerong at that time. You know, 1405, something like that. And Jetsun Kapa has this student named Ngawan Dakpa. And he's training him and teaching him. Ngawan Dakpa has walked all the way from Nevada to New York City for teachings. So Jetsun Kapa teaches him for a while, and then he says, okay, now you go back to Nevada and teach everybody else. And he's like, I don't want to go back to Nevada. He says, you have to go back to Nevada. You know, I'm your teacher. I'm telling you to go back. And not only that, you have to found 108 monasteries there. And don't come back till you're finished. And he's like, okay, you said so I'll do it. He walks back to Nevada, right? And we have this beautiful letter that Jetsun Kapa wrote him. Apparently, Ngawan Dakpa had collected together the first five students and made some monks, okay, like the first monks from Gerong. And he had written a letter to his teacher saying, hey, I got first monasteries done, you know, I got five monks, we had a ceremony, they all took their vows, and now I got 107 to go, you know, something like that. And we don't have that letter, but we have the letter that Jetsun Kapa wrote back, saying, I got your letter, I'm very proud of you, I'm glad there's monks in Nevada now, and It's very important that you made some monks, or it's important that somebody took vows, because most people don't understand that taking vows is what makes meditation successful. Okay? It's very interesting. You know, Jetsun Kapa then goes off into this long letter to his student describing the connection between leading an ethical way of life and your meditation. Okay? It's very interesting. And Jetsun Kapa says, you know, this is an ancient knowledge from India that to have good meditation, you have to lead a daily life which is very ethical, in which you follow ethical principles very carefully throughout your day. And then your meditation takes off. You know, people come to me and say, what's wrong with my how can I make my meditation take off? Say, Bok Jimba. Bok Jimba. Bok Jimba is untranslatable in English. It means something like to turn on the afterburners or something like that. It means your meditation's going at 50 miles an hour, and then you want it to go 500 miles an hour, and you can Bok Jimba. You know, Bok Jimba means to take it up to like 10 levels quickly. It's going like 10 times better right away. Okay, and that's to start keeping track of your day ethically. You know, have I been ethical today? Have I led a good life today? Okay? And if you start doing this exercise, which is like tracking your ethics, tracking the level of your ethical way of life, then your meditation Bok Jimba. Okay? It's a totally interesting thing. Apparently there's a deep connection between how good your conscience is and how good your meditation goes. Apparently, if the conscience has something sticky, then the meditation gets bogged down. And if the conscience is totally clear, then the meditation Bok Jimba, you know? The meditation takes off to another level, to a whole new level. So, you know, we're not talking about guilt or something like that. We're not talking, I don't mean conscience in that way. I mean that your heart is just happy because you know you haven't hurt anybody. Buddhist morality is all based on, are you hurting someone else or not, okay? And if you are consciously aware that you're not, or that you're doing your best not to hurt anybody else, physically, verbally, or mentally, then your meditation takes off. If your heart is clear, then your meditation takes off. Now, how do you do that? You know, there's a principle in manufacturing. I used to be into manufacturing, 15 years in a corporation. We made diamonds and diamond jewelry, okay? It's interesting. Diamond jewelry has like three parts. You know, there's a gold ring, there's a few prongs that hold the diamond down, and then there's a diamond, you know. That's all, you know. It's not like a car that has 15,000 parts or something like that. All the factory has to do is get the ring right, get those clamps right, and give them the right diamond, and that's, it's just three pieces, okay. So there's about 15 steps in that process. Someone casts the gold. Next person cuts off the place where the gold was injected in, and the next person has to file that bump off, and the next person has to polish that, and the next person has to put those clamps on, and the next person has to choose the right diamond, and the next person has to put it in there without breaking it, and then the last person has to put some kind of special coating on the ring, and then it gets sent out. So it's like 10 or 15 steps in the process. And we used to have it all on computer. We had 800 people working in the factory. We did 30,000 rings a day. And every ring is on a computer somewhere. And then suddenly we start noticing, we get, you know, we send out 10,000 rings to JCPenney's all over the country. And then we get this complaints back from Omaha and Butte, Montana and Dallas, Texas and Atlantic City, New Jersey. And they're all saying, you know, link number four there is always broken or always breaking or something like that, you know, or such and such a ring is always has scratches on it, you know. And then we would look it up on the computer and we could actually pinpoint which department and which three or four guys was doing all that, you know. And then we'd try to stop them, you know. We tried to go down and say, do you know you're scratching every single ring that comes out of your department has a certain scratch on it. And then we found out usually they'll just put two scratches. You know, like they get mad at you. And they'll just add some other scratches or something, you know. So if you accuse them of something, you know. So we found out this really cool way to get perfect rings out of the department. It was like we'd send them a memo and say, could you count how many rings come through your department with scratches, you know. Just count them. We don't care who's doing it or we're not mad about it or anything else. Could you just count them and Every day, give us a number. Is it 10? Is it 20? Is it 30? Suddenly, they stop. You know, the first day it's 10, second day it's 5, third day it's 0. You know, just because they're looking at it, that's all. You don't have to tell them to stop it. You just tell them, could you check, please? You know, and this is some kind of very cheap quality control. You don't have to fire anybody or hire new people or hire a consultant to come in and find out how to motivate them not to scratch the rings. You just count, ask them to count how many are screwed up, okay? And you can do the same with your vows, okay? It's an ancient Buddhist custom all through the day to watch yourself and check yourself every 2 hours. Every 2.5 hours, just stop and check yourself for 5 minutes or 2 minutes. If you get good at it, you find out it takes about a minute, okay? And so it's a very, very important custom. It is one of the keystones of tantric practice, okay? It is one of the foundations of tantric practice that you, every 2 or 2.5 hours, you actually stop and you spend just a minute or two to examine, what did I do in the last 2 hours? You know, did I hurt anybody? Did I do anything that hurt somebody? You know? And if you really ever want your meditation to be incredible, which it can be, this is the most important practice you can do. Okay, so you have to learn to do this practice. Okay, in ancient Tibet, they used to carry a pouch around with black and white stones in it, little pebbles, black and white, and they would stop every 2 hours, and they would, everything they could remember that they hurt somebody, they would take that many black stones out of the pouch and put it in their pocket. And then every time they could remember that they did something good for somebody, they would take out a white stones from the pouch. And then at the end of the day, they would empty out their pockets and count how many black and how many white. And that's all, okay? Nowadays, we have paper and everything like that. We use a little book, okay? So I'm going to show you how to do this check. Why? Because I'm teaching you how to meditate, okay? There's a direct correlation between checking your behavior during the day to see if you hurt anybody and the success of your your meditation, okay? If you learn to meditate well, you can see emptiness directly. If you don't learn to meditate well, you can't see emptiness directly. If you never see emptiness directly, you will live and die the way everyone else does. And you'll never know anything different. If you do see emptiness directly, you directly see the day of your enlightenment. And you know just about everything that's ever going to happen to you again. Imagine what that feels like. And anyone in this room can do that, okay? But you have to learn to meditate well, okay? You can get to a stage where you can see everything that's going to happen to you. And you can see your own enlightenment at the end of that. And imagine what it feels like to know that. You know, how would that affect your behavior? How would you feel all day long if you knew that? You see what I mean? Directly. But you can never get there if you can't meditate, and you can't meditate if you don't track it, okay? If you don't count your white stones and your black stones during the day. And it doesn't come from some extraordinary test that the inquisitor gives you at the stake, you know? It's not like that. It's every 2 hours checking to see if you said a little sentence that hurt somebody at work or something like that, okay? And the power of that makes you meditate very well, and the power of that makes you see emptiness, and the power of that, you can directly see what's going to happen to you forever, and the day of your own enlightenment, the day that you become the Buddha, you know, and everyone here can do that. It's very, very cool to walk around knowing those things, okay? Nothing like it, okay? So we're going to go through this tracking process, okay? We're going to give each of you a book like that if you like, okay? I have some friends who find this somehow, I don't know how to say it. They say, oh, I went through that in Catholic grade school, you know. They told me, you're a bad person, you know. You have to, you know, you ate fish. I have a student who actually, I said, how did you become a Buddhist? He says, I was 10 years old. I went to the church. And I went to confession, and I told the father that I ate meat on Friday, and the father said, "Get out of here because your soul is lost. You know, you will never, recover it. You know, you will go to hell. You will definitely go to hell. So you can just do what you want now because it's all over. You know, and for years he was all messed up by that. You know, for many years. I can introduce you to him sometime. I mean, if he allows me. But he actually, since that day, he was for 10 years. He was totally mentally all messed up, and he believed that. So I have friends who say that this keeping a book is too painful. It reminds them too much of, you know, Catholic school days or something like that. It's not the point, okay? It's not the point at all. It's not for anyone else. This is a meditation improvement book. You know, this is a book that helps you get enlightened. It's just something between you and yourself. You don't have to show it to anybody. You don't have to tell anybody. It's not for me. It's not for God. There is no God like that. There's nobody, you know, gonna punish you for doing it or not doing it. It's not the point. The point is to keep track of how well you're doing so you can get enlightened, you know. So don't think of it like that, okay? And I have students who, they show me their book and it was all negative, okay? It was all like, I'm a bad person. I hurt everybody. I could never be a nice person. I'm angry all day long, you know. As you'll see, this book requires, Buddhist custom requires that you track 50% the negative stuff you did and 50% all the good stuff you're doing, okay? So 90% of my students, Judeo-Christian background, all they want to write is the bad stuff they're doing, okay? You know, forget that, okay? Buddhism says that you are responsible to track 50% of your attention should be on what you're doing well, spiritually. The small successes you have, you must write in this book, okay? I always say that when they build a Buddhist cathedral in New York, it'll have confession rooms on one side and rejoicing rooms on the other side, you know, where you go in and you tell the priest what you did right, you know, or all the good stuff you did. So that's the first principle of this book. Don't make this some kind of a thing. People start to call it a confession book, and we had a big fight about it. It's not a confession book. It's a Buddhist paradise book, okay? And you got to think of it that way. It's not like some book where you keep your bad deeds. It's a book where you're tracking the negative side of you and the holy side of you. It's very, very important to keep tracking the good side. And to say, it's unbelievable today, you know. I, right in the middle of this argument, I finally shut up. Or, I let somebody else have the coffee before I took it. Or I left the last cookie for Sykes. Or, you know, something unusual, okay. And you'll find more. It's your duty, if you're going to keep this practice, to think of all the good stuff you're doing too, okay. All the improvements, okay. Even if they're small, okay. All right, here we go. There's a book like that. It's going to be, I'm going to divide it like that. And the custom is on the left side to divide it. You know what? I'll give you your books now. You can do the first one, okay? Does somebody want to do that? Can you hand this up? And then you divide you don't have to take one. Just do it if you enjoy it. Okay? If you don't like to be in total ecstasy for the rest of your existence or, you know, okay? I don't want to impose on anybody. Okay. And that other. Also, we're going to give you it's a card, right?
Yeah.
You get some kind of a card with all the bodhisattva vows on them. Now, if you didn't take the course in the bodhisattva vows, you have no idea what maybe 25% of them are about. You're allowed to read the bodhisattva vows, and you're allowed to try to keep them even if you never intend to take them, okay? It's just a cool way of life, okay? So you can go through these. We're going to give you a card that has all the bodhisattva vows on it. And even if you never intend to take them or you have not much interest in them, if you want to know the great things to track, these are the things to track, okay? These are the things to watch out for. These are the things that will make you very happy if you keep them. Okay, and you have to study those vows. Some of them are not what they sound like, okay? But you're going to get a card with all those on it too, okay? So it's not like you have these vows if you haven't taken them, and it's not like I'm saying you have to take them. I'm just saying, if you want to know what to watch for in your life, that's the easy, that's the great stuff. That's the powerful stuff to watch for. Okay. Those of you who have tantric vows, they're not on here because they're secret, okay? And you have to get them from your secret lama, all right? And that's all I can say about it. Okay. Any more here? Little one, if there's more downstairs and if someone doesn't have one, can you get them? Okay, so first make a, on the left side, make a grid like that, okay? Leave the right side open for now. Okay. I mean the left page and the right page, okay? So if you've got your book like that, make six squares on the left side here and leave this side blank, okay? By the way, well, I'll hold that one. Okay, first of the 10 Buddhist good deeds, right? Not killing things, okay? Not killing things. So you put that up in this corner. Not killing. By the way, I can't stress enough that if you do this practice, your life will immediately change, okay? You can come to class, you can take initiations, you can read books for the rest of your life, but if you don't examine your life from hour to hour, not much will change. I know lots of Americans who have studied a lot of Buddhism, they've taken from me personally thousands of hours of classes, and they didn't change much, okay? Because that's not what changes you. It's not the information, it's whether you apply it or not, okay? So this really does change you, okay? And the students I have who are using this, they are getting happier and happier every day. They're actually, their level of happiness is obviously changing. Everyone can see it. It's kind of cool. It's very encouraging, actually, okay? Because that's what all these classes were about. I used to think I just had to teach people. And then it dawned on me that it didn't matter how much you know if you don't do something about it, you know. And so you really have to do this if you want any change to take place. It's nice to know everything. But if you don't do this, I don't think you'll change much. You won't get much happier just by knowing a lot. And you definitely won't get much happier just by taking initiations and then not keeping any vows. And every great lama in history has said that. From ancient India to all four traditions of Tibet, everybody said the same thing, okay? There are many, many texts about, Milarepa said it, Naropa said it, all the great lamas of the Sakyas said it, the Nyingma said it, everybody said it, okay? Same thing. If you don't keep track like this, you know, you won't get very far, okay? And I can show you those quotations because they're just, people write books about that because apparently somebody in Tibet was saying, oh, you don't need all that stuff, you know? And you know, somebody said that the Kagyus don't say that. And then Jetsu Kapa quotes about 50 Kagyus who said that. And he says, well, who else do you say who didn't say it? You know, and all the great lamas of Tibet said this. All the great gurus of ancient India, Lord Buddha said it, okay? Lord Buddha made up this practice, okay? All right, not killing is the first one. Then personally I say, okay, it's 8 a.m., and I'm at the Colonial Cafe. You know, I just like to, I don't know why, it just seems like it's good to say where I am and where I did it, you know. And I'm checking this vow. It's 8 o'clock in the morning, okay. First thing you do is figure out something you did positive. Okay. What's the closest I came to protecting life in the last day or two, okay. The rule about this is you have to be specific, okay. It's better to have one insignificant, specific thing than 10,000 general things like, I'm not a very good person, or I get jealous sometimes. We don't care. We want something specific, okay? At 4 o'clock yesterday, in front of this person, I got jealous of this person for 5 minutes. That's all. Not asking you to correct yourselves that much, right? This is the factory manufacturing theory. Just watching it will make you change. It's very interesting. Just examining yourself changes yourself. You see what I mean? So, what did I do that was good today? Okay, moved a bag out of the way. Okay, did I save a person's life? Did I jump in front of a taxi cab and shove them out of the road? You know, no. The closest I came to protecting a human life today was that someone put a bag across in the corridor. The strap was hanging out. Somebody might have tripped on it and hurt themselves. And I took the time to push the strap back. That's all. That's all we're looking for. This is how you get enlightened, okay? This is how you go to a Buddha paradise. It's by watching the small stuff. Really, honestly, okay? You don't get a chance to throw somebody out of the way of a speeding cab every day. It's this level of caring for other people that gets you enlightened. It's the little things, okay, that you do every 5 minutes, every 10 minutes, okay? It's very, very profound, and it seems very mundane. But it's actually the way you get to a Buddha paradise in this lifetime, is by watching this kind of stuff. Is there something in the way that might trip somebody, okay? And this is secret of Buddhism, you know? This is the real truth about Buddhism. It's paying attention to these small things all around you. How many people here have met all living beings? I mean, if you're going to wait until you get a chance to save all living beings, you might be waiting for a long time. The truth is, you have to deal with the people right around you. Unfortunately, the people you have to treat with compassion is your family, the people you work with, your boss, the people who work for you. You know what I mean? Like, it's not this glorious thing where you come out with a golden star on your chest and save all living beings, you know. You have to learn to deal properly with the people in your immediate area. Because if you can't deal with them properly, it's hopeless for all living beings. They is all living beings, okay, for you. I mean, I have many Buddhist friends who seem to oblivious of that, you know. I mean, apparently there's this big population of living beings out towards Mars, you know, and they're very easy to be compassionate towards because they're so far away, you know, and it can't be like that, you know. You have to deal with the people right around you. You will get enlightened on the basis of how you act towards your family and your friends and the people at work and the people in New York around you. That's obviously, that's how you're going to get enlightened, is by how you act with them, okay? So, move the bag out of the way, positive. Negative. These are real life cases. Okay. Ate too much cake at an Italian restaurant. Really, last night, okay? Around 9 o'clock. Okay. 9:30. Anyway. Okay. But that's not killing a sentient being, that's killing myself. I is a sentient being. You gotta remember that too, okay? Is suicide wrong according to Buddhism? Yeah. In fact, it's the worst form of killing. It's worse than first-degree murder. Okay? To ruin your own chances for enlightenment is more grave than ruining someone else's. Okay? It's interesting. So, no problem to add that in the killing. Okay? Because killing yourself is also killing a sentient being. Okay? Then we put a little to do. Okay? To do. No sugar today. Okay? Today, rest of today. Okay? Okay? Something very modest, something very easy. Don't put there, we'll never eat cookies again, you know? The lamas of the lineage say that then you collect a new bad deed of lying, because you will eat cookies again. Okay. So you set a time limit. You say, okay. By the way, if it's a mental vow, like don't get angry, this could be 10 seconds or 10 minutes, you know. I won't think of so-and-so for 10 minutes. I mean, I won't get angry at so-and-so for 10 minutes. Something you can control. Okay. To say you're never going to get angry again, we don't want to hear that. Okay. It's not true. You're just collecting another negative action, okay? Put something here which is very doable. Very. And since you're going to have six of them, come on, make it small. Okay, don't like pile yourself up in those more stuff to do. You know, don't say, we'll go volunteer at the hospital for 6 weeks or something. Which you could do that if you want, but I mean, these should all be something fairly immediate that you can do. Okay, something doable, and don't put too many. I have friends who are workaholics, Petra McWilliams. Okay, and I read hers. You know, and she's got like build hospital for children in India. And then she's got six of those a day, and she was like, after a week, she was like shaking, you know, like, I got too much to do, you know. I said, no, don't do, it's not like, do something that you can do, okay? Something modest that you can do, okay? And that's what one entry looks like. Okay, 2.5 hours later. Like I just put up there what time it is and where I am. It's 10:30 now. I'm at work. Okay. People tell me they can't do this book because they're busy at work, you know. And there are days, I don't know, like when I was in corporate life, 3 or 4 phones at the same time, literally at the same time. How am I supposed to stop for 10 minutes? What's my boss going to think if I do that? We have in this room right now a very successful corporate officer, you know, and he... He keeps it in his scheduler. Some of my corporate friends keep it in their address book, you know. So there's never an excuse not to be looking at your Casio, you know, and typing something in, you know, or your address. What do you call it? Your scheduler, you know. Like, do I have 15 minutes to talk to Joe Schmo out in Connecticut, you know? And really, they're just writing their thing, you know. People told me I was in a board meeting all day. How am I supposed to do it there? There's people sitting next to me. I used to do it. I was in the board meetings. I was a VP in this huge corporation. I'd say, I got to go to the bathroom, guys. I'll be back in a few minutes. You know, you go in the stall and you close it and make sure nobody's peeking and you pull out your thing and you do it, you know. And you can do it. It's no problem. It's really no problem. Okay, if where there's a will, there's a way. Okay, it's not a big deal. Do you find time to go to the bathroom when you need to? Mostly. Do you find time to eat when you're hungry? Yes, you know. Do you manage to get yourself dressed every day? For 15 minutes or 2 hours, depending on how much makeup, okay? But you do, okay? Somehow you manage all those things. Well, you can manage a book. You don't tell me you don't have enough time to... It takes like... How long it took to do that, I don't know. 30 seconds? 45 seconds? Okay? This is going to get you enlightened, all right? And it really works, okay? Okay, so positive... Negative, and to do. By the way, if you can't think of anything specific, then the principle is free associate. Seriously, okay? Got the check from Barbara. I always suggest to put initials, okay? In your book, in case your friends read it. Okay. I put them in other languages so that nobody can, and I mix them. And I make code names for certain people. Okay. Anyway, I was in a restaurant, this lady tried to pay, I distracted her and got the check back and, paid. Okay. So that's kind of like avoiding stealing. See, it's not exactly, but it's, see, you go free associate. Okay, something to do with money that you did right. Okay, and then something negative. Let so-and-so pay for the cab because I was too lazy to get my wallet out or something. Okay, something like that. Very often I'll see here when students ask me to check their books, and I like to check people's books just to see if you're doing it right. I don't care about your personal life. I mean, I care, but not in that way, okay? Here it's very frequent. People will put made phone calls at work. If your boss specifically asks you not to do it and you know they would consider it stealing if you did do it, then it's stealing. You see what I mean? not showing up at work on time when you did promise to show up at work on a certain time. You know what I mean? There's a lot of work things that are like that, that are dependent on your own boss and your company and the prevailing customs in your company. Like if it's common in your company to go ahead and make local calls for 5 or 10 minutes in the morning and then it's considered okay, then it's not stealing. If the boss has clearly asked you not to do it and you continue to do it, then it's stealing. And if you don't like it, then move to a different company. But it's stealing if they think it's stealing and they own it. You see what I mean? So if you disagree with them, don't just do it and steal. You see what I mean? Then go to a company where they think it's okay to make a call home in the morning. Okay? Something like that. But it depends on what the person who owns it thinks. You see what I mean? Is taking a pen from work stealing? Is it considered stealing by the owner of the company, by the management of the company? Or is it considered like, well, you know, everybody's going to go home with a pen in their pocket once in a while. It's not a big deal. You see, I mean, depends on the prevailing morality of where you work. You see what I mean? And if you don't like it, if it's too strict for you, then go somewhere else. But don't break it. You see what I mean? Because that's only hurts you. It's only bad karma for you. What's this got to do with saving all living beings? If you act on this level about pencils and phone calls at work, you are quickly going to see emptiness. Seriously. Very seriously. Okay? If your morality comes down to pencils and phone calls, then your mind is going to be clear enough to see emptiness directly. Very cool. Okay? That's the reason to get it down to that level. Okay? What to do about it? I don't know. Put some money in my pocket next time, okay? At the beginning of the cab ride, like get it out, ready. If you have a friend who always pays for everything, like when you both go in a cab somewhere, they tend to pay for it, then try to even it out. You see what I mean? Like try to make sure you got $5 ready in your pocket, and then you can beat them to the draw, okay, like that, all right? Like that. You tend to get lazy. You tend not to think about it. You know, this person always pays, so I won't bother, you know, something like that. And this is a plan. Very specific, okay? You can say for this evening or something like that, okay? And if it comes down to this kind of behavior, you will be... If you're very good at this kind of stuff, and if you check it every 2 hours, your life will change, okay? I call it, there's like 5 levels. One is you start to feel better, physically and mentally. Second level is like neat things start to happen, like, you know, you go to work and they tell you you have a small raise or something like that, okay? Then there's, if you keep it up for a while more, you get like surprising things start to happen. Like they call you in and say, there's been a stock split in the company, we decided to give everybody some stock. You're like, I never thought my boss is so cheap, and now he's offering me stock. You know, this is really weird, you know? And then there gets to what we would call the amazing but possible level. You know, like they bring you in, they say, now you're vice president, you know? And that person that you didn't like that you used to work for, well, now they work for you, you know? And I call that the amazing stage, okay? And then there's just the flat-out miraculous stage. I mean, things that just shouldn't happen, you know? Like... No, I mean, like you go into a restaurant and you eat a big meal, and then they bring the... You ask for the check, and they say, no, I won't give you a check, you know? And you say, why? And they say, because I know that you're practicing this tantric practice, you know? And you're like... And this waitress looks like some older Israeli lady that you never met. She has no way to know what you're doing. You know what I mean? And she says, have a good night. And she turns around and walks back to the kitchen. You know? And that's exactly the order in which it goes. If you keep this stuff, I swear to God, it goes like that. Okay? It really does go like that. You know, slight improvement, surprising, amazing, almost impossible, and then clearly impossible stuff starts to happen to you. Okay? And then finally, according to Buddhism, your own perception of your own body and mind changes, and you are a tantric deity. And this is exactly how it works. It's just plain old schmucky stuff all day long, Watching that stuff. That's how you get enlightened. That's how it happens, okay? You don't get a chance to throw your body to the lions or, you know, that comes once in a lifetime, okay? We're talking about stuff that happens every 5 minutes, every hour, every 2 hours. And if you hold this line, then all of those things I mentioned will happen to you. One by one, they will happen to you. It's very amazing, and it works, okay? Just try it for a while. By the way, if you don't try it for a while, it won't work, and I promise you that. If you do it once in a while, it won't work, and I promise you that. If you get to the end of the day and the whole thing looks like this, it won't work either, okay? Every 2.5 hours, okay? Every 2.5 to 3 hours, depending on how much you sleep, okay? I don't know. Okay, what do you put over here on this side? By the way, where do you get the stuff to write in here? That little card you have. If you get to a bodhisattva vow there that you don't know what it means, go to the next one, okay? And if you keep coming here, you'll learn them, all right? Those listed there are the most powerful karmas that exist. There's 84,000 other good deeds you could be doing. Buddha said these are the most important. If you want to get to enlightenment fast, concentrate on these, okay? These are the most important ones. If one of them sounds weird and you don't know what it is, just go on to the next one, okay? And then slowly you'll learn. You'll take the courses here. There are courses about what those vows mean. And then later on you can actually take those vows. By the way, between keeping them because you've always acted that way and keeping them because you swore to do it is a huge difference, okay? As soon as you can, as soon as you feel comfortable, try to take a vow to do it. You know, somebody says, I don't have to take layman's vows. Why? Do you know what they are? Killing a human being or fetus, okay? Stealing something of considerable value from somebody else. Sexual misconduct in the form of direct adultery with another person's married spouse, okay? Lying about seeing emptiness or not, okay? And then taking, you know, like drugs, you know, or something like that. And then people tell me, why should I take lay people's vows? I don't intend to do those things anyway. I never did them, you know? Big difference between doing it because you're under vow and doing it because you don't feel like doing it or you don't need to do it right now, okay? Big difference. The karma is much more powerful if you've made a decision that you want to get enlightened and keep this as a vow, okay? So as soon as you can, as soon as you feel comfortable, you should think about making some kind of commitment to act like that, okay? Okay, what are you going to do? By the way, so here's going to be what? 12, 2:30, 5... 7:30, and then you just fill them out like that, okay? Yeah.
I want you to clarify something.
Yeah.
If you do it with a bodhisattva vow, it's going
to take 9 weeks. She's absolutely right. She says if you do the bodhisattva vows this way, which is 64, you know, 64, 18 root vows, 46 secondary vows, and a lot of other little stuff, it's going to take you a long time to get through them. I'll tell you a secret about secret practice that I'm not supposed to tell you, okay? When you take tantric vows, you get 100 and something vows. Okay, you are required, technically, to check all of them 6 times a day. Okay, I tried it once. I was in retreat. I didn't have anything else to do, you know. I got up at 3:30. I started checking them. I have 484 vows. Okay, 253 monk's vows and 231 other vows. Okay, I started at 3:30. I finished at 11 p.m. I didn't finish checking them once. Okay, I mean, and then I said, this is clearly impossible, you know. And then I went and checked and asked lamas, and they said, this is a great way to do it. What happens is, if you have all your tantric vows, bodhisattva vows, and layman's vows, it's 43 vows apart. Okay, so that means that, you know, 6 divided by, every 7 days you're hitting the same vow again. They cycle through it, you'll hit the same vow again in 7 days. Something like that. In a week, you'll get to the same vow again. Because you're doing it 6 times a day. Something like that. So you don't have to feel like this is all that's practical and this is enough because you can concentrate. And this is the custom. Okay? So no, you can't cover them all in one day. And the goal is not to do that. You know, if I told you, okay, you have to do 243 vows a day, you wouldn't do it. And you can't do it. Okay? You just can't. All right? By the way, if you keep this up for a couple months, they become part of your life. You see? You're keeping all the other ones too, just by habit. You see what I mean? And so that's how you cover the other vows, okay? Now this side, what are we going to do? You go like that. By the way, you came here hoping for some spiritual stuff, you know? You wanted something amazing to happen. I mean, you were thinking about miracles. I mean, in the deep in your heart, you would like it if something like that happened at a cafe. You know, if you got some real confirmation in the normal world that amazing spiritual things could happen, this is exactly how to get it. And I'm not kidding. Keep this and all, you will see all the miracles you were ever hoping for. You know what I mean? They are possible. They happen all the time. They happen to people who keep their life in this kind of order. And that's the only way for it to happen. You know, you have to change something about what you do to make that thing happen. Don't think it's impossible. It's not. You know, all that stuff you ever heard about, you know, all the stuff that you, as a kid, I used to read about Jesus. I'd say, man, those were the days, you know. You never hear about anything like that happening nowadays. Nobody's turning water into wine. You know, nobody's walking on water. Nobody's taking one loaf of bread and then suddenly it's enough to feed everybody and they got more left over at the end than they started with. And I mean, that doesn't happen nowadays. It does. It can. Okay? Those things really happen to people. And they don't have to happen to Mother Teresa, you know. They can happen to you. They really do happen to you. You can. It's very exciting to know that religion might work, you know. And you just have to, this is how it works. This is how it happens, okay? You gotta try it. It's just amazing. It's really cool. Okay. Now, what if you went through all the first six, let's say tomorrow, what are you gonna do? You start on number seven, okay? Number seven is here. I guess that's what I should have answered your question, right? Maybe that wasn't clear. So you're gonna have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, six. And then tomorrow, the next day, you start with 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. And then the next day is 13, 14, okay? You keep cycling through the vows, okay? So let's say you get to the next day. Let's say you try this tomorrow, Tuesday, right? Then on Wednesday, what's the first vow? Number 7, okay? You're going to start 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. And then, was it Thursday's going to be 13, 14, 15, 16, 17.
This started on
13. Yeah, whatever. You can start anywhere you want. Okay, cycle through. Okay. Let's say on Wednesday I kill somebody. Okay. I mean, I really do it, you know. Finally get my boss, okay. And I killed somebody. Unfortunately, that vow was yesterday. Okay. So what are you supposed to do about it? By the way, according to Buddhism, bad karma doubles in power every 24 hours, okay? I mean, if a monk or nun tries to hide something wrong that they did, within 24 hours, it increases by double. Every 24 hours. It's exponential. After 2 days, the karma is 4 times more powerful, okay? Like that. The effect it has on your subconscious, on your spiritual life, is that destructive. I mean, it's important to write it quickly and to deal with it, okay? So, am I just going to wait until number one cycles through again? And for me, it would be like, I don't know, 7 days. You know, do I really want it to be 250 times more powerful or something? You know what I mean? No. So what do you do? At the end of the day, you do your three best and three worst. Three best, three worst. I said, I put the killing the boss over here, right? Okay. All right. Improve the office. Okay, something like that. Okay. Something like that. But anyway, at the end of the day, okay, just before you go to bed, okay. It's very, very important to go to bed with your conscience clean, okay? It's very important. It's a big Buddhist custom to, if you die in your sleep before you wake, you know, it's better to die clean, okay? Seriously, all right? So just before you go to bed, it's good to do that. I like to do this before any big event during the day. I don't especially stop at 10:30 to tell you the truth. I mean, Like before breakfast, which is a big event, I do my book. I mean, I try to take events during the day that work out to about 2.5 hours. You know what I mean? Like, I have to teach a class at 7, I do a book just before that. It also gives you very good energy going into an action. Like, if you have an appointment with a customer at 3, do it at 2:45. And there's some kind of purification. There really is some kind of extra energy you go into that event with. You know what I mean? It's very interesting. If you have a normal career, then, you know, I do it before I do something important during the day. And it seems to work out to exactly 6 a day. There's about 6 important events during the day, and they're about 2 hours apart, 3 hours apart. And that's a good way to go into something important, okay? It's a very nice custom to do it that way, okay? Up here, put other things that you're trying to track. Everybody should put meditation. And that's at the end of the day, you make notes about how'd your meditation go today. Okay? And track it like you're a scientist, you know, like, tried to visualize my lama today, couldn't get the left eye too well, hope to do tomorrow better, you know, or, you know, this is the 15th consecutive day I didn't skip my meditation, it's really improving, you know, make yourself notes. I like to say where I was, who I was with, and how did it go. You know, and then I make myself little notes like, you know, tomorrow try not eating pancakes right before meditation. Or, you know, I leave myself little notes to read later that will improve my meditation. But the point is, you will quickly realize if you didn't do your meditation, because it'll keep being blank up here, okay? Meditation is just like jogging. If you don't do it every day, forget it. It doesn't work, okay? It has to be regular. It has to be at the same time every day, okay? Mostly, unless you have a really weird schedule. If you travel a lot or something, that's different. But it should be at the same time every day. Okay, and meditation is really... Last thing, I often put here something else I'm working on. Like, for me right now, it's eating sweets, okay? You know, and I just make myself know, this one doesn't last very long, maybe a week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks, you know, or how am I doing with this particular person? Like you're having trouble with one particular person for a week or two, and track them separately, you know, in the evening for about a week. Okay, like something special, short-term problem that you're working on. Okay, like I tend to be jealous of this person, and isolate it and treat it separately for a while. Okay, like that. Okay. Again, please remember to do the rejoicing part, the happy part. Okay, very important. You know, it's not a book that's meant to concentrate on your bad side. It's meant to track your spiritual life. Okay. And if you do this, said Jetson Kapa, then your meditation will bok jimma. You know, and it's very cool. You'll see your meditation take off. You'll say, my God, I can sit there for an hour and I go through these incredible levels and see all this stuff. And I didn't know that was ever possible. I wonder what's going on. You know, I wonder what changed. And it's this. It's whether or not you keep this. Okay. So keep it for your own good. You don't have to tell anybody you're keeping it. You can do it secretly. Sometimes it's even better, I think, to do it that way, you know. And it's not something that I'm going to check or blah, blah, blah. It's for you. Okay, it's because you want to meditate, and if you do that, your meditation goes good. If you meditate regularly for about an hour a day, sooner or later you will see emptiness. If you study and meditate at the same time regularly, you must see emptiness directly. Okay, and again, on that day you see directly the day of your enlightenment, and you see pretty much the details of the wonderful time you're going to have until then. You know, and nothing really bad is going to happen between now and then. And to see all that directly and to go around life with the confidence of knowing what's going to happen to you and where you're going to be in a certain number of years and what Buddha you're going to be and stuff. It's very, very weird, you know. It's very, very unusual to live like that, okay. And you can do it, okay. But you have to start with this, all right. Okay. I got one extra book. Anybody didn't get one? No? Okay. Maybe I have to keep one. No. No, I think all my really good students keep them, and they all have a really good time with each other, because also it improves your karma, so it looks like everyone around you is nicer than they were 6 months ago. Really, they're not, but no. No, they really are, because it's your karma is changing. So then the whole world, the office seems better, New York City starts improving, the people around you start changing. Okay, it's very cool. It's very cool to watch it happen. Okay, we'll do a short prayer and then we'll stop. Okay, and next week will be the last class. Also, in the next class, the last one, I'll give you a schedule for 99. We have all the dates picked out for the courses. And there are also some different courses in other countries and other states that you might want to come to. Okay? And we'll give you that next week. Okay? Who's the Unze?
Sangye Shindu Mete Uwagi Dokunam Dakshina Chibasho Idam Guru Radna Mandala Kamne Yatayami Kewadi Kewokun Sanam Yishe Sozoshin Sanam